Hi and welcome to another episode of Dr. Mommy Speaks Parenting Podcast. I'm Dr. Rahat and I'm excited to share with you that we're now being heard in over 51 plus countries. A big thank you to all my guests and my beloved listeners for this milestone. In other news, back in India, the COVID crisis is nowhere near being contained, with daily positive case count reaching close to 4 lakhs per day. I would humbly urge you to donate and help with the availability of beds, oxygen, and medicines in this time when our health infrastructure is crushing. And if you're in India, then please stay home. Double mask up and take care of your loved ones. We'll get through this, inshallah. On a happy note, if you're a parent to a 9 to a 13-year-old, that is teens and tweens, then this is for you. Registrations for my course, From Instructional to Conversational Parenting, are open, but the seats are filling fast. Over these 5-day live classes, you will learn how to get your teen to listen, how to discipline them without yelling, tools for a safe digital online experience. Then we'll talk about how to teach your teen decision-making, how to talk about topics like cyberbullying, pornography, sexting, and how to raise emotionally stable and happy adults. The course begins on the 20th of this month, and if you miss on any of the classes, then you'll get pre-recorded lectures to catch up. So click the link below, and if you are from outside India, then simply send me a DM for an exclusive link to join. And getting on with today's episode. Imagine a room with people, mom, dad, grandparents, and a few kids, say teenagers, all of them glued to their devices. Now, this isn't an uncommon sighting, especially post-pandemic. If your house looks anything like that, then today's episode is for you. Hi, I'm Dr. Rahat, and for today's talk on how screens have impacted our lives and interpersonal relations, we have with us a special guest, all the way from Boston, USA. He is the Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the Harvard Medical School. He practices adolescent medicine at Boston Children's Hospital. His innovative child health research has been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, CNN, NPR, and more. He has authored policy statements on media and child health for the American Academy of Pediatrics. Please welcome Dr. Michael Rich. Hi, Dr. Michael. Welcome to the show. I'm so delighted to have you.
I'm delighted to be here. I've been working with colleagues in India for quite a while now and look forward to further work with you.
That is amazing, Doctor. Now, according to the words of Dr. Rich, we need something better than opinions when it comes to technology use and its impact on our kids. So now this is so true. Before we dive into the topic, I'd like to know something, Dr. Rich. You are the head of the Digital Wellness Lab at the Boston Children's Hospital. What's this initiative all about, and what can parents expect from it?
The idea of the Digital Wellness Lab grew out of work we've been doing for almost 30 years now, looking at the influence of the screens we use and how we use them. We started this work in the days of television, when people were concerned about sedentary behavior affecting our weight, when we were concerned about the content affecting our anxiety or our aggressiveness, and also whether that kind of passive receptive screen use was affecting how children learn. However, after almost 30 years, as I say, of doing this work within the ivory tower of academics and medicine, we feel that we are not having the effect we need on the entire digital environment. Ultimately, what our research has indicated has been that what we are using screens so much, and obviously this has increased during the pandemic, but we are using screens so much that for children, they are in front of screens for more of their waking hours than anything else they do. When you add in multiple screens, multitasking, it's even more. And so we're taking a step back from looking at these screens as vectors of education or of potential harm, and really thinking about them as the environment in which we live. It is the air that kids are breathing. And so we really need to learn to use good public health science to understand how we are affected by those screens and how we use those screens that is affecting us. The idea of the Digital Wellness Lab is, instead of, you know, cranking out our academic research and our clinical programs and then having the tech industry and the entertainment industry play defense or explain why they can't or aren't doing things, is to take a different approach and say to them, let's not turn you into the tobacco companies of the 21st century, right? Because you have a product that is not toxic when used as directed, unlike tobacco. The problem is that without that direction, without some guidance, and frankly, without some design work on the front end of these technologies and the content that they're putting out through them, we need to learn all of this stuff to live well with these media. In other words, we're going to be living with them anyway. We have to be realistic about it. And we're in this terrible position where the only options that are being offered are turn it off, cut it down, restrict it, as opposed to how can we improve it? So the idea is to stop criticizing and start synergizing with the tech and entertainment industries and bring our respective skill sets to bear on moving the ball toward a better environment for our children to grow up in and for all of us to live in.
Right, absolutely. Now, there are so many educational videos and apps that make education so much more informative, and they break it down into simpler terms so that children can grasp. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But the problem comes when there is an unrestricted use and children start binging on it, whether good content, educational, or something for fun and entertainment. But then when it's for a longer period of time, that's when the physical harm starts to set in. So you really put it right that the digital screens and the digital world is like an environment for the kids now, and we need to start accepting that. So
right, and I would say that we're approaching it kind of like nutrition. If you think about it, nutrition is something where there are things that are good for you, things that are not good for you, but you can also get too much of things that are good for you, and so. What we really are looking at this is a diet for the child's growing and developing mind as well as body.
Right. So as per your lab's first pulse survey amongst the parents, the effects of technology use on kids during the pandemic. Well, the results have been pretty contradictory to each other because, a few of the parents have found media really useful to handle the kids in the pandemic, while a few had seen the side effects of kids sitting for a very long time on screens, turning irritable, cranky, and things of that sort. So can you share a few snippets of the study with us?
Absolutely. And I think that what we're seeing here is exactly what we were sort of proposing, is that this is an environmental effect that affects different kids differently, different families differently, depending on how they are using them. For example, as might have been expected, they virtually all, or the vast majority of them, reported increased use of screens. Now, a lot of that was because schooling was now on screens, et cetera. But actually, some of them saw a decreased use of screens. And one of the things that we're seeing there and understanding is that even for the young people, you know, who used to come rushing home from school and get in front of their screen to play games or get on social media and saw it as a playground, now when they spend 5 or 6 hours of schooling on screen, they want to close that laptop down and go outside and run around and do something else. So they're actually understanding that this is a powerful tool to be used in certain ways, but really is not a playground anymore. It's a place where they are living their lives, transacting a lot of the things in their lives. So one of the, I think, positive things we have found about this acute on chronic situation with screens that we have faced with the pandemic. If you think about it, kids were already using screens a lot of their days. And this just kind of bumped it up even higher. It's sort of like someone with asthma getting pneumonia on top of it. So we do have this acute on chronic, as we say in medicine, situation. Yes. And we have a variety of responses to it. For example, in the schooling area, 62% of our parents felt that their kids did as well or better with learning things like mathematics and science and English. But obviously some of them felt that it was not as good. And some kids in particular had difficulty with online schooling, with paying attention, with staying engaged. And I think that what we're also seeing here is what we call differential susceptibilities. Some kids are more prone to using these devices effectively. Other kids are more prone to, you know, kind of going down the rabbit hole of excessive use, whether it be gaming, et cetera. And so this is not a one size fits all situation. This is a situation where we have to know the child, we have to observe the child, we have to stay in touch with the child in their digital lives. And I think one of the things that the pandemic has also done, really in a sense by force of the fact that parents and children were stuck in the same place 24/7, is that parents have become more aware of and more involved with their child's digital lives. And whereas before they kind of checked out from their kids' digital lives, assuming the kids were, you know, more facile with the devices, and went to places that they parents didn't understand or had the time to go to. Now I think they're realizing that their kids are spending so much time in the digital space, they have to parent them in the digital space. So I think that while 62% found that their learning or their information transfer part of their education had gone well, over a third of them felt that their kids' social emotional learning suffered. That, you know, school is not just about learning things. It's also about learning to be an individual in society, to establish yourself as an individual separate from your nuclear family, but also figure out how to communicate with people, how to negotiate, how to resolve conflict, how to get along with people, and how to decide what people you don't want to bother with and who don't want to bother with you. I mean, this is the reality of human life. And that really suffered in this environment, both because the schools have not been able to pay good attention to it, and also because this environment doesn't really speak to that effectively yet. And what many of them have done is gone online to massively multi-user online role-playing games as their social emotional learning. You know, things like Fortnite and Roblox and Minecraft, where the kids essentially were hanging out with their friends, which is how they talk about it. They don't talk about it as gaming. They talk about it as hanging out with their friends. But they're not hanging out with their friends at school or at home where there is some adult presence. There is some adult oversight of what's going on. And so there is a tendency for it to become something of, you know, Lord of the Flies, if you know that novel, where kids are on an island together and it deteriorates because, you know, they sort of go to being barbarians. That doesn't happen all the time, but the potential for it is there. And so I think that one of the things we learned is that as we move into the new normal, which will not be like the old normal, we have to pay attention to the social emotional learning of our young people. And I would say a final thing that was quite interesting was the prevalence of physical problems that the parents reported their kids had after remote schooling, everything from headaches, eye strain and pain, to back pain, sort of the ergonomic issues. And so one of the things, obviously, that we will learn from this as we move into the new normal, which will include some elements of online learning, the proportion of which we don't know yet and will probably vary across schools dramatically, is that we can't sit them endlessly in front of a screen. We have to get them up, moving around, you know, getting a snack, getting outside before they sit back down to it to give their eyesight a chance to recover, but also give their backs a chance to recover. And frankly, to hit the refresh button on their brain, you know, to get moving and get the blood pumping to their brain, get them looking at nature outside, something else, before they go back into the two-dimensional environment where they are looking at a picture of their teacher or their classmates, which is not a great analog for real life.
Absolutely. Like you said, talking about teens and tweens who are glued to the screens for playing video games. For them, they're not playing games. That is more like we're hanging out with our friends. And also, you know what fears me the most is our kids turning into zombies. Like you said, that screens cannot be a one-size-fits-all. Some children might find it really informational, might take a great deal of information from the video or app that is going on. But the others, something happens and they just turn into zombies. That's my red flag for knowing how the content is that I'm exposing my child to. Like, instead of seeing the content, I aim to see at my child and his reaction. Like, is he interacting? Is he laughing? Or what's his expression? Or is he blindly just staring at the screen?
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing. And it goes back to parenting. You know, the role of parents is to be acutely aware of their child's, you know, presence, if you will, in life. What are they looking at? What are they hearing? What are they saying? It's observing our children and listening to our children. And most importantly, it's being present in their lives, not just their digital lives, but their whole lives. And one of the other things that we are finding that is really critical, particularly in the early years, is parents' screen time. You know, the time that parents are staring at their phones, they are not there for their children. They're not there to hear their children's needs, to respond to their children's needs. And the kids see that, and they not only feel rejected, but they feel like this is how you behave as an adult. So the parents are modeling this behavior for the kids. And just one of the interesting things that I do with my patients, many of whom are adolescents, so I'm seeing them without their parents, is I will ask them, what could your parents do better? I know that's subversive, and I know that makes parents really nervous, but here's the interesting thing. I would say, and I should get hard numbers on this, but 3/4 or more of the time, the first thing out of the child's mouth is, pay more attention to me.
Oh.
Be more present for me. Listen to me. Now, these are kids whose parents think their kids don't want to talk to them, that their kids are sullen, you know, and they're asked, what did you do today? Nothing. You know, how was it? Fine, right? You know, that there's not a lot of exchange. But the kids actually are desperate for the parents to pay attention to them and to be there for them, even though they kind of make it hard work at times. So there's that. And I do want to respond also to your concern about the zombification of kids, you know, these kids staring at screens. We have to understand that games, social media, and other interactive sites online are designed on a variable reward system, which B.F. Skinner back in the 50s and 60s experimented with. And it's the same kind of reward system as happens with gambling, which is that when you give something every time there's an action, that interaction extinguishes itself very quickly. But if you vary that reward, that if you do something and only sometimes do you get a reward, whether it is, you know, winning a game and being advanced to the next level, whether it is likes on your social media, et cetera, that draws people in and keeps drawing them in. This is not a hold your attention. This is re-grabbing your attention over and over and over again. And again, this goes back to the differential susceptibility. Some kids are more susceptible to these, and we need to keep an eye on that. But we do have to understand that the content that is there is designed to grab them and keep re-grabbing them, because the metric for success for these folks who are designing games and social media is eyeballs and clicks, you know, how much attention they can draw, because that is their currency. That is how they generate business. And so that goes back to this observing your child and seeing how they're responding to it.
Right. And that re-grabbing of attention, the entire science behind it is the reason why push notifications work. You know, Instagram, Facebook, the notifications directly rewire into your brain and get your attention back. Okay, there must be something, though, you know, it's a comment, it's a like or a share, but you still want to know what it is, what makes you keep getting back to it.
So, right. It works on us. It works on definitely. Us extremely well. But we theoretically have a mature prefrontal cortex, which has impulse control, future thinking, all of the executive functions. Now, I won't disparage anybody's prefrontal cortex, but we are vulnerable to being sucked into that. Now, think about what it's like for the child who has 10 or more years till they mature their prefrontal cortex in the mid to late 20s. And you realize how much harder it is for them to regulate their use of these materials and these media.
Absolutely. So let's counter some common questions that most parents have about technology use for kids. So the most common one we get is it okay for my baby to video chat with family and friends?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the really good uses of these technologies, particularly in the pandemic era and times when we are physically separated from them. One caveat, though, is that it appears that unless the child actually has a real life interaction with those people, you know, before going on screen, it doesn't connect the same way. And so they need to have met grandma and grandpa. They have to have, you know these people. And the other thing to be aware of is attention span. Babies have a fairly short attention span. So this is yet another example where we need to observe our child. And you will know when her or his eyes drift off the screen or they're not involved. And it's time to end the conversation. Now, the friend or family member may not be ready to end the conversation because they're at a different place in their life. But we have to help them understand that this is valuable to a certain extent for the young child. But what they really need to do is more short interactions than one long one.
Absolutely. So next one. What if a child is about to have a meltdown after her demands for a screen have denied? Now, this is so common. And as a parent to a preschooler, I know what a real struggle this is. It's like repeating the same thing again and again, but expecting a different answer when you're talking to a preschooler. So how do you suggest we tackle this?
Well, I think that this is, for one thing, this is another example of observing the child, et cetera, but also to helping the child understand that this is a privilege, not a right, to be able to use these screens. And that if they can't manage both using them effectively and doing other things effectively, stepping away from them, that needs to be decreased or removed until they're able to get it together. There's nothing that says we have to give our preschoolers tablets or smartphones. And I think one of the things that our research and clinical work has shown over and over again is that we have to introduce these devices and platforms to the kids and constantly observe it and treat them as tools, not as toys. When we treat them as toys, then taking it away can be, you know, seen as a punishment, et cetera. And it should not be used as a reward or punishment. In other words, if you're quiet, I'll let you have some, you know, screen time. Or if you're not, you know, if you're not behaving, I'm going to take it away. The only time that it should be used in relation to the screens is when they are having problems managing the screens themselves. So the, you know, the punishment should fit the crime, as they say. and that if they are demonstrating that they can't get off when it's time for dinner or for bed or something else that's an essential part of their life, then we have to explain to them calmly that they're going to have less of it, or maybe not at all for a while, so that we can lower the hyperstimulation, hypersensitivity, and help them recognize that it is part of a rich and diverse menu of experience.
Right. And also as a parent, I'd like to add that, you know, bringing in screens in every other conversation, like you said, if the child is not doing something, I'm going to take the screen away. If you go to bed on time, if you make your bed, you're going to get like 10 minutes of screen. So you yourself right. are making screen sound like something really amazing, and the child is starting to look up to it. So first of all, we got to disconnect from this concept and start making use of screens less and less. And that's when the kid will start, you know, it'll be easier for the child to move away from the screen then.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, it's not even about making it less and less so much as making it optimal for their lives. In other words, if we treat it as a tool for communicating with family and friends, a tool for learning, a tool for exploring the world, but it is one of many tools that they have. And just like any, this is really a power tool. So we wouldn't hand an electric saw to a four-year-old and say, have at it. We would wait until they needed the tool and they could handle it responsibly. And then we would teach it to them side by side to be sure that they were safe, to be sure they were using it well, and quite frankly, to have time together, to bond with each other. And that's what we really recommend that parents do with these screen devices, which is help the child learn to use this power tool the same way they would an electric saw, or the way we teach them to drive. You know, we don't just throw car keys at young kids and say, you know, don't come back till dinner. has to be treated with the same level of respect. And we as parents have not done a good job with that. We've used these screens as electronic pacifiers. We've used them as rewards, or in their taking away, as punishment. And that is treating it as something very special that the kid wants all the more. And we set them up to subvert that system, to hack the system and try to get more of it, despite what we are hoping for them.
Right. We're showing them just how to do it, how to get your way.
Yeah. We're teaching them manipulation. What a terrible thing.
Yeah, that's all. Okay. So video games. Regular rules for playing video games or watching Netflix are now lax in many homes owing to the pandemic. Now, the result of all of this is your child is being exposed to mature content. From what research says, and also as a parent's general concern, kids who watch violent or sexual TV and videos or play mature video games may be influenced by their content, and they may begin to think that violence is okay and it's an okay way to solve problems, or substance abuse is fun, or that casual sex is popular and consequence free. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, absolutely. You know, kids are learning from the screens they use and how they use them. They are learning from Gully Gully Simpson on one side, you know, in India, and they're learning from Call of Duty on the other. Yeah. But, you know, what's different is only the content of what they're learning. We can't have a sort of ambivalent or ambiguous approach to it. In other words, thinking that they're learning from educational television, but they're not learning from video games. That's the first thing. The second thing, quite frankly, is that the vast majority of the research to date has been cross-sectional research. So for example, with violent video games, and yes, we find that violent video gamers tend to be more aggressive, less pro-social than kids who don't play violent video games. What we don't know is whether kids who are more aggressive by nature are drawn to video games, or whether the video games are increasing kids, aggression, or both, quite frankly. I mean, it could be that it's a spiral that is happening, that they're drawn to the games because they're aggressive. The games encourage or validate
now,
that aggression.
As a parent, I would definitely like to take a safer side and not give those video games a benefit of doubt. So I'm going to try to keep the child away. So how do we do that then?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what we have to understand is that all media are educational. What differs is what they teach and how well they teach it. Interactive media, such as video games, are better teachers than passive receptive media. But we do know that, because, for example, with violent video games, not only are they exposed to it the way they might be watching a movie or television show, but they are participating in it. They are a player in that drama, and they are rehearsing violence over and over and over again, which at the very least desensitizes them to violence. And in some cases may actually encourage or teach them violence as a means of conflict resolution, et cetera. So I'm absolutely in support of parents saying, there's just some stuff I'm not going to, let you use or buy for you. But I think we have to couch that in why. Why I don't want you playing Call of Duty or Grand Theft Auto. Because otherwise, if it's just the forbidden fruit, they'll go over to their friends' houses and play. They will, they'll play on the school computer if they can, whatever it is. So we have to simultaneously protect them from these things. But the best protection we have for them against such influences is between their ears. It's educating them to protect themselves and to respect themselves and others in the digital space.
Absolutely. You're right. Now, in most parts of the world, learning is now online, and children are supposed to be glued to their laptops for 4 to 6 hours to gain something educational. But what they're losing in return is their physical health. Like we spoke about, the tech neck syndrome, stiff shoulders and neck. So what can we do about this problem of online learning? And yes, I call it a problem because as a parent, I'm not okay with its physical effects on my child's health. I'm literally waiting when the pandemic is going to get over and children get to be children again by stepping out.
Yes. I think your instinct is right, and I would strongly encourage you to act on it. We have to understand that the schools are still learning how to do remote learning well. And so they need our feedback. And the feedback that I have given to schools that I've advised on this is a couple of things. Number one is don't use the same class period lengths as you use when you're in the classroom, because it is a much attenuated situation and the child has to work harder to decode that two-dimensional image and sound into what is the pedagogical vibe, if you will, that happens between teacher and student, between among classmates, etc. So that's the first piece, which is that we need shorter time periods. And obviously, the younger the child is, the shorter their attention span, the shorter those lessons should be. That those should be punctuated by encouraging the kids to get up and move around, go get a snack, take a walk, do something, and get their blood pumping again, not just because of physical health, which I think is important, and changing position, which is exceedingly important, but also it will refresh their brain. And so that the next, 20 minutes or 30 minutes in front of a screen, they will be alert and focused on the screen because it is now, once again, novel, as opposed to same old thing. And so I think that it really adds to it. I have encouraged parents to have a dedicated place in their house where their child works on schoolwork. That would be both classwork and homework. Even if they use the same device recreationally to chat or to game, et cetera, to do that in another physical place in the house, because that ritual, that routine of sitting down to their desk to do schoolwork, whether it's synchronous with a teacher or asynchronous with projects or homework, really helps them structure that time.
Just like we'd have in a school.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And remember, schools have recess. Schools have, you know, as they get older, they have kids getting up from one classroom and walking to the next classroom for the next class. That is an important part. That isn't just, you know, logistics. That is an important part of their school day. It's where they interact with their friends. It's where they, you know, get their blood pumping again, get a breath of fresh air, get moving. And they're able to then change channels, if you will, to use old TV technology, to change channels to the next effort. And then it's something fresh as opposed to just more of the same.
That reminds me, my preschoolers, online schooling, they do this ritual in between an activity or two. They're going to start playing If You're Happy and You Know It. And all of the kids are supposed to stand down, raise their hands and jump and everything. And I've noticed every time at the end of the song, my boy's attention is absolutely back and he's ready for the next activity. That explains so much.
So you should compliment your teachers for thinking of that.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we really owe a great deal of debt to our teachers who have remarkably quickly, completely transformed their pedagogical style and at some times great sacrifice to them. So we owe a shout out of thanks and also admiration to the work they've done.
Yay to the teachers for learning and changing and doing so much for our kids. Right. And in such a short span of time.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that brings me to my next question. Instagram and Facebook. Instagram and Facebook are two famous social media sharing apps which are used massively by tweens and teens. In fact, my previous episode was on safety tools for parents on Instagram that can help you create a safe online experience for your kids. Now, these sites are great for connecting with friends and for recreational purposes, but when we're talking about kids who are still in their formative years, then these can be a breeding ground for trouble. What I'm referring to is body image issues, low self-confidence, hate comments, and so much more amongst tweens. So how can parents moderate the use of these apps? Because there's no way, if I'm going to tell my teen that, you know, I don't want you to use Instagram, it's bad for you, there are strangers lurking around, they're going to track you by your location, none of that, nobody's going to listen to me. So how do I help them have a safe online experience?
Well, here's an important feature of what our work has shown us is that one of the arguments I have with the tech companies, because I work with Facebook and through them to Instagram, which is a Facebook product, is that with all the best of intentions, they talk about internet safety. And I'm telling them, you got to stop talking about internet safety. And they're sort of surprised, you know, sort of say, what? But we're the good guys. We're trying to do good here. And I'm saying, but the problem with talking about internet safety is that it presumes the internet is unsafe and a place to play defense against. What these kids need is to learn internet mastery. If we go back to the power tool analogy of an automobile or whatever, we don't teach them to use a saw by saying, don't cut your hand off, or teach them to drive by saying, don't run over people. We teach them to master the tool. And that is very important to them learning in the process of that mastery, learning to be safe, right? Rather than to be afraid. When we approach it as something that's unsafe, it also has that certain attraction that smoking cigarettes used to have, right? That just be, you know, if mom and dad say it's dangerous, it must be pretty cool, you know. and so I think we need to shift our relationship from internet safety to internet mastery. And in the process of that mastery, they are learning that they have to take responsibility for everything that they receive, and even more importantly, perhaps, post online, because they are creating a digital footprint. They are creating a trail of breadcrumbs, if you will, to their personality that will be looked at by college admissions officers, that will be looked at by future employers. And anything they put online, I tell them, it's going to go far, it's going to go fast, and it's going to be sticky. It's going to stay somewhere, and it will come back. So I urge them to use what I call the grandma rule, which is don't put anything online you don't want grandma to see, because she can. All right. And that's really important. This illusion of privacy is there. But ultimately, when you come down to the child's safety with posting things, is we have to help them learn to use social media not as a tool for marketing themselves to the world by showing how, you know, my nice new outfit or the hot car or my good-looking boyfriend, right? But more to be authentic online. And if you think about it, we lost a lot when friend became a verb, because true friendship is built on our need for each other. And that is built on our limitations and our vulnerabilities that allow others to complement us and complete us in ways to support our limitations and allow us to support their limitations. Now, I'm a great optimist as a pediatrician, and I believe that the human nature will improve gradually and incrementally and in fits and starts over time. But I truly believe that if we can learn to use social media correctly, and we are not using it correctly now, we are using it to market ourselves to the world, which means that other people come to it and say, everybody is better looking, richer, happier, and more successful than I am. So they come to it seeking social interaction and come out of it feeling like they are, you know, pale by comparison to what's out there. But let's imagine if a young person in a country is being true, being authentic, and talking about the things they struggle with, talking about the things that make them feel good, things that make them feel bad, to another child in another country. I think this can be an instrument of peace and of human globalization, so that when the leaders of those respective countries say to the children, take up arms against them, they're going to say, why? I know them better than I know you. Why should I hear you saying, you know, they are the enemy? Because that's another 14-year-old kid halfway around the world from me who may dress differently than I do, who may worship a different God, who may, you know, have a different color skin, have a different lifestyle. But you know what? They like playing football, right? And so they are more like me than not like me. And I think that this is, if we do this right, this can be a great tool for understanding and connecting with what, you know, historically has been thought of as the other, somebody who's different than me. So we can be more inclusive and open-armed to our friends around the world.
Actually, as humans, we are scared of anything that is different from us. It scares us. So this platform, the social media digital world that connects us globally, is the best way to get to know and find similarities that can help us unite. That was a monumental advice for teenagers to use social media.
Oh, absolutely. And it is how we use them, not the media themselves, that are the problem. Right. And that are the solution, which is if we use these in ways to connect and find our similarities, but also our complementarities, the thing, you know, if we can see each other as enriching our lives with differentness as opposed to threatening us with differentness, I think we will evolve to a higher level, quite frankly.
Absolutely. And while we're at it, let's discuss another common problem that is seen in teens and tweenage group, cyberbullying. So what are its signs, and how can we as parents support our kids and handle the situation well?
First of all, by introducing these devices and platforms as power tools and doing them with our kids, helping them learn to use that electric saw or that automobile in ways that are safe. But doing it in a way that is not judgmental or shaming of the child, that is helping them to, use it well, but keeping a door open to communication so that they don't feel they have to go underground and hide what they are doing, from their parents, but to say, and to help them understand that they are going to run across things online that will confuse them, that will upset them, and that they can come to you at any time, that you are part of their digital world. You are parenting them in this digital space. So I think that that's really the key thing here is, how do we help these kids grow up in a digital environment in ways that help them be smarter, stronger, healthier and kinder to each other than our generation has been?
And absolutely, our generation didn't have to bear so much of cyberbullying. I mean, the maximum we had was being hit by the ball in the school every time there was a games period. That was bullying for us. But then here, right, our child might be suffering from cyberbullying in the form of violent or hate comments under every post. And that could be every day. And we wouldn't even know what's going on inside the minds of our teens. Right. So the primary...
Our research has shown that 58% of kids who've been involved in cyberbullying have not said anything to an adult.
Exactly.
And that is not because they think we don't care, but it's because of what they think we are going to do in response to it, which is take away their devices.
Exactly.
Take away their platforms. And to them, those devices and platforms are actually shields, are actually protective. They know what's going on. The most important thing is open and non-judgmental dialogue with your child all along, so that when they have something, that bothers them, they're going to talk about it. Because the other issue here is kids don't have necessarily the insight to understand when they are cyberbullying someone or being cyberbullied. There's this issue of how much of this is just teen drama and how much of it is truly problematic. There's also the sender-receiver issue in cyberspace, which is when you are bullying someone in real life, you see their response to it. You see them cry, you see them run away, whatever, and that can be the information necessary to build your empathy for them and stop doing it. Online, you never see that response. And so, you feel safe in a way to be nasty online. But also, you may be thinking you're just teasing a friend, but the friend will receive that as an insult or a harm to them. So I think the key here is, to be very explicit and open with kids that cyberbullying happens, that first of all, if it happens to them as a victim, that they should talk about it with you and you can help them. So instead of sort of waiting for them to say, this bothers me, say, this is likely to happen in your life in some way, and I can help you sort out the drama from the cyberbullying. Or how to resolve these issues. And I think that's really important. I think also to help them understand that they may be cyberbullying themselves or inadvertently causing harm themselves. One of the things that this environment has done because of the lack of synchronicity and presence with it is there's a huge rise in what we call the victim bully, which is someone who is victimized in cyberbullying and turns around and cyberbullies someone else so that they can feel more powerful. That doesn't happen in the playground. It's clear who the bullies and the victims and the bystanders are. But in cyberspace, it's much easier to be both, and there's a huge overlap there. The other interesting fact is we have found that cyberbullying is almost three times more prevalent in girls than in boys. And that is, if you think about it, what is in parallel with traditional bullying. You know, traditional boy bullying is beating up the little guy. Traditional girl bullying is psychological warfare, right? It's ostracism, slandering, it's shaming. Right, exactly. And so this environment is more useful for that kind of, you know, rumor mongering and slandering, et cetera, that happens in girl bullying and thus is much more prevalent among girls.
Absolutely. So one way that in which parents can help support the children in this cyberbullying thing is to not make a big deal out of it, to be supportive and, you know, communicate, keep that space open for communication so the child will approach you. And first of all, assure them, we won't take your devices away.
Exactly. I mean, because that's their great fear. You know, people talk about FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. What I find in my patients is actually more powerful is what I call faux blow, which is fear of being left out.
Oh.
You know, that you are, if you're not online, if you're not involved in the chatter, that you will be left out and ostracized and not be, you know, with your peers. So I think that we have to pay attention to that as well as FOMO.
Absolutely. What can, you know, there's another parent question. What can I do if I see my teen watching pornographic material, which is very common for their age group, but it's not right? So what can we do? How to approach that situation?
Well, first of all, I think that it's very unlikely they will ever see their teen watching pornography because the teens are smarter than we are. So they're good at hiding it. But the flip side of that is I think we have to understand and be very explicit, just as we were about cyberbullying, that the kid is going to come across pornographic material online. And we need to be straight up about it. I think it is easiest to start talking about this before they are a teenager, and start talking about it not in terms of it's evil, it's bad, it's immoral, more in terms of it can harm you and those you care about because it does not portray sexual activity accurately. It portrays it as something that everybody always wants. It is portrayed as something that is a transaction, not an expression of trust and intimacy and love, and that they are the ones who will suffer from it. I personally have seen a number of patients, mostly young men, who got to college age and said, I don't know how to express sexual or romantic interest in somebody else because I've spent my adolescence masturbating to pornographic material, right? And so I never learned to translate my natural sex drive into connecting with other people. So in some ways, their sexual development is stunted in that way. But I think that we don't serve this issue well if we sort of pretend it's not there and try to blinder our kids to it. Because the average age now of coming on pornographic material is around 9. And so they're going to have seen it before, you know, they hit puberty. They're going to have, you know, interacted with it. And that's when it's easier to talk about it because it's all kind of confusing and weird to them. And ultimately, we have to teach them, if they are looking at it, that it's fiction, that nobody actually, it looks like that these are extremes in terms of their physical endowments, if you will, that nobody acts that way in real life, and that sex is something that is, if it is removed from intimacy, if it is removed from trust, if it is removed from a relationship, is no more than just another physiologic act like urinating or defecating, right? That it's just relieving something, but not really enhancing our lives. And so they are diminishing themselves and their potential by, you know, going to it. As easy and fun as it may seem at the moment, there are long-term implications of it. And I would stay away from the moralizing, because that just ends up making it that much more attractive, kind of like tobacco and rock and roll and all those things that we like all the more because mom and dad don't understand it and don't like it. Right.
So yeah, that's the typical teen psychology at that age. The overall thing that I got from this was that when you need to talk to a teenager, when you want your teen to not do something about it, don't tell them it's bad, or don't put your opinion on them. How about let the teen decide? They are mature enough to understand. And that's going to depend upon how well you're explaining it to the child.
Right.
Yeah,
and explain it as limiting and harming them, not as something bad, because when it's something bad, it becomes that much more attractive.
Exactly. Adam's apple.
Yes, exactly.
So, Dr. Rich, you came to medicine after a 12-year career as a filmmaker. That's what intrigued me the most in your bio. Before we close, I'd like to know what pushed you to make the switch, come into medicine.
Well, to make a very long and winding road short, the pinnacle, if you will, of my filmmaking career was working with Akira Kurosawa, the great Japanese film director, as his assistant director. And then coming back to Hollywood and realizing that I had just gone from Rembrandt's studio into a factory. And I really came to film wanting to change hearts and minds, wanting to understand the human condition and relate it in terms of story and narrative, and was frustrated. And so I actually had an early midlife crisis and said, I don't want to spend the rest of my life creating artifice, particularly artifice that is not all that interesting, because it's hard to make a living making meaningful films about meaningful things. You know, if you can't do comic books, you really are not going to make it. So I had my early midlife crisis, and the only other thing that I was interested in doing was yet another profession that allowed me to get close to the human condition. And so I went back and went to medical school and became a pediatrician. And I don't regret the change, but I also don't regret having spent the time learning to synthesize human experience into a story, into a narrative. Excuse me.
No, this is actually monumental, you know, having a midlife crisis. And the maximum people do is, you know, go on a shopping spree or maybe change houses. The way you've changed your career and then done so much in it is really nice. And the way it's going to your studies and your digital wellness lab initiatives, the way they're going to help children is going to be amazing.
Well, let me tell you one thing that may involve you and your audience is that we are currently doing a project called Growing Up Digital Global. Growing Up Digital, its initials are GUD, so we call it Global Good, doing good. I am working with the Indian Academy of Pediatrics, to have a site in India where we are following two cohorts of children, one starting at ages 3 to 5, one at ages 13 to 15. And we're following them annually, year after year, measuring their media use, their ambient exposure, but also a whole host of health and developmental outcomes, so that we can break out of this cross-sectional mode that we're in with, for example, violent video games, and really answer the question of, you know, what kind of exposures cause or influence or contribute to what kinds of outcomes. And so we're going to follow them over 10 years, annually over 10 years, and see, just like the Framingham Heart Study, see how this environment is influencing their healthy outcomes, but also their, you know, professional outcomes. I mean, are these kids doing well in school? Are these kids getting good jobs? Are these kids being social, you know, pro-social people in their lives? And start to really answer the questions about the long-term influences of the screens we use and how we use them. We're looking forwards and we're following them year after year, actually using a methodology we developed on smartphones. So the kids actually are collecting all their own data and telling us what they're doing and why they're doing it and with whom they're doing it, et cetera, which is really, really interesting.
That is amazing, Dr. Rich. That's really nice. And that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you, Dr. Michael, for this amazing and insightful session.
It was fun for me too, and I can't wait to work with you again and again.
Great. So that's it for today, guys. You all can connect with Dr. Michael on Instagram. His handles will be linked in the show notes below. Until then, happy parenting. That's it for today. Do subscribe to my podcast so you will be notified each time a new episode is online. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn as Dr. Mommy Speaks. Don't forget to like and review our podcast wherever you listen. It will help others to find this podcast. And you can visit our website, drmommyspeaks.com/podcast, for all our show notes and any resources mentioned by me or my guests. And while you're at it, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter. Until then, happy parenting!